Hello, folks, and welcome to the Metallica Report. I'm Stefan Shirazi, editor of the band So What magazine.
And I'm Renee Richardson, director of philanthropy for Metallica's foundation, All Within My Hands. This is your official weekly Metallica podcast, the only inside source, bringing you all the news from the band's HQ and studios deep in the heart of Northern California. Steph, got to welcome you back.
Thank you.
Me and the ladies, we were having a rager without you last week.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you for allowing me back in. You all absolutely killed it with last week's episode. So I'm privileged to be allowed back in. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, no, honestly, we missed you. It was fun to do, but you were missed for sure. And before we fully dive into things today, I'm just looking at our Spotify poll. And Steph, I know you were looking at it too.
Yeah, right. We asked folks which Greg Fiddleman produced album is their favorite. Well, 72 Seasons has pulled in nearly half the votes.
I'm not necessarily surprised by that, but I am surprised that only about 5% of people on Spotify who answered the poll picked S&M2.
Wow.
Because, I don't know, I feel like that was like a beast of an endeavor. It was a huge project, and it's one of the ones I listen to a lot. So, I don't know, a little surprise there.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm going to win a lot of fans here. I think the work on Lulu was pretty great too. I really do. But that's for another time. They'll get into all that. But look, you might have sort of had a guess at what's coming. We've got a great one lined up for you this week and also next week. Because when we were at HQ recently, Renee and I got to sit down and chat with a producer. That man was Greg Fiddleman. You might have guessed that, right? Have I said that enough times already? I think so. Look, Greg needs no introduction, but let's give him one anyway, shall we?
Yes, let's do. First of all, I love that Greg was in the band Rhino Bucket back in the day. Fun band. If you don't know him, you should check him out. And his experience in a band probably also helped give him this edge when it came to becoming a producer, because he already knew what bands were like to deal with, and he knows what they want. And he also had the musical chops to speak music, if you get my drift on that. So just the right person for the job.
Yeah, the right person for the job indeed. I've got to go back and say, if you did the HQ walk around with us, you remember we pointed out a painting, Greg Fiddleman, that was done by our very own Jenna. Jenna, I just want you to know that when we talked about the bucket with Greg, you were foremost in our thoughts.
Absolutely. Yeah, true. No.
But everything you said about Greg is absolutely true. It must have helped being in the bucket as he was. And since his first two albums as an engineer for Bruce Dickinson and then Sick of It All, Greg has worked with a ton of heavyweight names. Pick a couple here. Johnny Cash, Neil Diamond, Adele, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Slayer, anyone? There's loads. And I must personally mention High on Fire and their Snakes of the Divine album. Scorching stuff indeed. But it is his work and relationship with Metallica that Greg is best known for. It started when he was an engineer and mixer on 2008's Death Magnetic, before he ascended to the producer's chair for Lulu, and Greg has been there ever since.
And his role has since expanded as a result of working on the S&M2 project to include live sound consultation and overview, which means Greg pops up on the M72 World Tour to check on things from time to time. He's a very busy guy who, let's remember, recently won a Grammy for the 72 Seasons album. Yay, Greg.
But before we get rolling, a word from our delicious sponsors. We've been speaking a lot about how health and nutrition has changed in rock and roll over the years, with exercise and nutrition replacing all-nighters and junk food.
Yeah, and last Wednesday, after another crazy day around here, I was very happy to have my Factor meal delivery on hand. These chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and pre-prepared meals are delivered to your door, and they're ready to heat and eat whenever you are. Let me tell you, it was a lifesaver on that day.
And what's more, Factor Meals has many options for every palate and dietary need. 35 of them, to be precise, ranging from keto to calorie smart to vegan and to veggie.
And no joke on the vegan veggie meals. I tried those, and in minutes, I was able to have something super yummy. The spices that the chefs are using are incredible, not the stuff that I normally keep around. So it was really convenient and nutritious. And there's some proper gourmet elements involved in Factor meals.
Yeah, I picked a low-carb keto meal, and I had this turkey chili and zucchini with ancho lime creamer, which was so tasty that I thought I'd try another low-carb keto meal, herb-crusted chicken with mashed cauliflower and toasted almond green beans, which was absolutely as tasty as it sounds.
Dude, you are making me so hungry. Factor meals, restaurant-quality, feel-good meals. They offer a variety of easy options for any time of the day. They've got breakfast, midday bites, dinner, even snacks and smoothies and wellness shots, which I love.
Yeah, and we've done the math and figured out that Factor is less expensive than takeout. And it's also healthier. So, I mean, look, what's not to like about that, huh? Let me add to it that if you head to factormeals.com/Metallica50 and use code Metallica50, you will get 50% off.
Super easy to remember. The code is Metallica50 at factormeals.com. Metallica50 to get 50% off.
So, as we said at the top of the show, this week and next week's pods are all about our conversation with Greg Fiddleman. So let's head to the jam room and get rolling with Greg as part of our continuing HQ adventures. Well, part of our continuing adventure here at HQ. We're delighted, aren't we, Renee?
Oh, more than delighted.
Welcome Greg Fiddleman to the chair here, sitting in front of James's section as you are.
In front of his pile of shirts.
Obviously a room you're very familiar with and a studio you're very familiar with.
Yep.
By the way, I have to thank you, actually, because there was, from SoFi, at the rehearsal, there was a version of Fight Fire with Fire that I kind of freaked out on. I'm like, this is the greatest version of this song I've ever heard. I mean, I felt. And I asked Jason Gossman, who records the stuff, and he pulled it.
Right.
And he and you said, no, let me get in on this. I'm going to do a little bit of cleaning. And so so thank you very much.
You're we have very this welcome. Yeah.
Exclusive version of Fight Fire with Fire, which I think we'll have to play a little bit of.
Okay.
I've been trying to think of a time to play it.
Right.
And it's like, well, you know.
Sure, yeah.
You did this little gift and it was super cool. And I loved it. Can I tell you, when I got it back, I swear to God, I listened to it like 10 times.
Wow, great. Yeah.
And every time I'm just like, this gets better and better.
Yeah, it was pretty, no pun intended, it was kind of fiery performance. And, you know, it was like at a stage rehearsal, right? The day before a gig or whatever, when they're just kind of like getting their footing in that venue and no one's being too careful. Which is a good thing sometimes.
Right. Yeah. So tight. And why don't we start? We'll start there. I mean, why not? You know, you have taken on a role where you are helping, you know, you're kind of a fifth member in the sound supervision department. I mean, you can instantly feel when something's on and when it's off.
Definitely, right? Yeah.
How? What are the indicators?
Well, I don't know that it's something that you can put your finger on specifically, but you feel, it makes you feel a thing or you're, it's, you know, it's just in the pocket or whatever the particular thing is. It's all coming together in a certain way. You recognize it. I don't really know what that is. I thought about this sort of thing before. Like sometimes you hear a song like, oh, that's going to be good. Even though what just happened, like when we're writing or whatever, you just know like, oh, that's going to be a moment that people are going to like a lot when we're done with it. So I don't know really how you would describe what that is. You just sort of recognize it. It's probably just makes you feel like you felt when you were 16 years old or something, listening to a Judas Priest record or whatever it is, like that wow kind of thing that happens inside your head.
So it's more visceral than technical.
Definitely, yeah. Yeah.
Even though, I mean, you're a very technically astute and you've, I mean, obviously you consider it a great importance, but there's an important emotional bond.
Then. Definitely, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and do you look to any particular band member as the keying off of that emotion as you're, and you know, both in the studio and maybe live? I mean, is there one member that you're like, he's on it?
It's a pretty collaborative effort there that they do, but it certainly starts with Lars. And, you know, Lars and James, more than most parts of bands that play this kind of music, they are a little bit. Yeah, I don't know that they're necessarily individuals when they're doing what they're doing. They sort of become its own little thing, like a two-person monster or whatever you want to call it. And when they are locked, it's a sound that we are very familiar with. And I don't think it's, I mean, it doesn't take someone like me to recognize it. A lot of people can recognize it. And then, you know, obviously Kirk is a very different guitar player than James. And then when he's on, it's adding another layer of stuff that you can recognize when it's on. And, you know, Rob is unreal and he's pretty much always on. But yeah, I think it starts with the two of them turning into one thing.
Can we talk about box sets for a second? What brings you more joy, having your hand in reworking these iconic albums or doing something from the ground up?
A ground up thing is definitely where the big joy is for me, but I still like the other stuff quite a bit too. So not to say that that's not fun as well. The box set sort of stuff, and I've done that on the whole catalog going backwards, is extremely interesting because I get a weird microscopic view of someone else's work that I respect and certainly can learn from. So it's very interesting for me to kind of, you know, I have to dig into it in order to do what I'm being asked to do. So also interesting to hear the guys, you know, hearing drum tracks of Lars, you know, from whatever, Puppets or something. Me and my engineer, Jim, not that long ago, were listening to something off of the Lightning record or something. And we're both just like, this is insane. Like, this is so, it's definitely, this is the song I know. And I know that that's Lars. And I'm listening to the basic track, like drums, bass, you know, that's with Cliff and like one guitar. And you're just like, that's insane sounding. That's, I know it's them. It is quite old now, not to put age on anybody, but they've changed as players a lot. And obviously sound, just the way people want to sound, has changed a lot since then. But there's something really fun about getting that weird view into the old way that they did it. It was very interesting.
It is interesting because you have developed a sound with this band that is very unique. It is a very, very strident and strong personality in that sound. You're now doing the live sound as a fifth member. So when you go back to remix, how does that work? Because obviously you're looking to preserve the era, but how much of what the band sound is now comes into your head when you're doing that?
Actually, very purposely, and I have conversations with Jim and Sarah and Kent and whoever else is working on it, Dan with me, about not doing what we now do. The idea is to not push it into sounding like they sound now. The idea is to embrace what they were doing then and try to make it like when you hear even a guitar sound or a drum sound or something, like this should sound like from, you know, 1994, that what those records sounded like and what they sounded like live. So you
have to check yourself, I guess.
Definitely, yeah.
I mean, are there moments where you're listening to stuff and, oh my God, I really want to do this?
I guess not so much, really. It's, and then, you know, the other thing about those old projects are they're all like the current stuff, because the guys for now a long time, really, I guess, have been, I guess, since maybe Saint Anger, I'm not sure, certainly since Death Magnetic, they record every show, but it's for the most part, there's a few exceptions, but for the most part, they're recorded in very much the same way. Every show is recorded the same way. And the way we do things now, that's actually quite important, so that we can kick out, you know, every live show goes up, gets mixed and goes up. And the idea is that we could turn around quick. And the fact that the recordings are very consistent helps immensely to be able to do it quickly. Where all the older stuff, you know, this show was recorded by this truck company with these engineers on a 48 track dig. And then the next show is a 24 track analog recording with different, they're all very, very different sounding. Technically, especially, they're very different. So each one has its own bizarre set of problems that you have to identify and then figure out how to solve. And that is also what you were asking about, what's funner. That's a lot of what's fun about that, is that it's, because I suppose you could say that the newer stuff, if you have to mix 10 shows in a row, it starts to get a little, you know, you can get a little nuts because it's the same thing. And this is also, obviously, there's different songs too from this era. Because each show is different, you're forced to just almost reinventing your process each time, which is kind of fun.
How much of what you have done with this band do you consider to be personality wrangling?
I mean, a lot. But I don't know that that's very different with other bands too. Maybe a little bit, just because this relationship now has been going on for quite a while. But a lot of it is managing that aspect of stuff. I think also sort of taking the heat. I know this is something I learned early on is sort of, there's no rare, once in a while, I suppose there is something that can come out of a disagreement that turns into something closer to an argument between band members. But for the most part, it's not really helpful when people are pissed off at each other.
Right.
Better that they're pissed off at me because then they can also have a bond that we hate that fiddleman guy. So it's sort of like I'll try to sort of steer, I'll take on the disagreements and the arguments or whatever you want to say, whatever you want to call it, so that they can be their best, you know, and feel their connections between the four of them.
When did you first get comfortable doing that? I mean, when was it? Do you remember?
A great question.
Do you remember a time where you're like, okay, this is the moment I have to be the sponge here?
That would be hard. It was a slow roll for sure. It's been a while now. I'm sure it really came to be sometime during the Hardwired album, for sure, is when that really sort of got locked in and not at the, you know, the first bits of the Hardwired record where we were still writing and sort of assembling, putting songs together and whatever. I remember that was a little challenging and their lack of, they had to start trusting me a little bit more than they had in the past, even though we'd known each other at that time for, I don't know what, how many years, 7 or 8 years or something, probably. But certainly by the time we were well into the project, it started to be a little bit different.
You realized that, okay, all right, I'm going to have to sponge some of this up to help it through.
Yeah.
I think maybe it's worth going back now to Death Magnetic and the entry point with the band, right? I mean, maybe get into that and maybe get into a little bit, obviously, of coming in with Rick Rubin. I mean, I think it's probably not an unknown secret, which would make it not a secret.
Right.
Actually, wouldn't it? Isn't that right?
Yeah, that would be.
It's not a secret. All right. Goodness gracious. So Rick, he's a very sort of organic and I suppose a holistic producer who is very much about bringing the vibe out, etc. But you were thrust into the thick of it in terms of actually getting the sounds. Is that a fair appraisal? And if not, correct it and tell us how it worked.
That's in the zone of it for sure. He was had a lot of trust in me, and he doesn't want to get weighted down with getting into the weeds of all the ins and outs and all the individual things that you have to deal with and cutting together tracks and that sort of thing. But the one thing, you asked me something about when do you know when something's good or earlier in this, I forget how you worded it, but...
Good for you. It was probably too long.
It was probably too many words. But there one thing that I always was cool about the days when I worked with Rick is that we certainly had a very, not just in Metallica records and all the records that I worked on with him, there's always moments where, like, you know, he's usually, you know, I guess, you know, a lot of people, you know, sitting on the couch behind me or whatever, where you're doing it, you know, tracking or a vocal overdub, whatever it is, where you're like, oh, that's awesome. And you look back and he's like, yeah, that's, you know, we make a little, like a look at each other. I'm going to have to say it, just like, yep, there it is. And so there was always a very a common switch that we both had that made us recognize when it was what we wanted and when it wasn't what we wanted. So it's like sort of beyond a trust thing as much as it is just a common...
You're in sync where that goes.
Right, yeah. So, but yeah, maybe we're straying from your question, but...
No,
but
please keep straying.
It was always like a key thing. It wasn't so much trust as it was I would know, like, if I was working, and I have this with the guys too, especially with Lars, I think, like, oh, that he's going to love this. Like, I don't, and he knows now, after he's finally gotten to trust me over the years that they have, he knows that that's going to happen also. Like, he's not worried about me missing something that he liked because he knows that if he liked it, I noticed it.
Rick's a very warm, I mean, he's quite quiet, but he's a very warm person, and he's a vibe. It's always been a vibe. I mean, do you think at that time of your career, coming in, working with the band, just having someone of that personality helped maybe give you extra confidence to do what you were doing and helped give you another dimension of belief to know where you could go? And if that, you know, includes doing the Johnny Cash stuff and so on, please bring that up.
I think, again, you know, not to stray too far, but before I worked with Rick at this capacity that we're talking about, I was in a band who made a couple records. And when we got a lucky enough to get a record deal in the late 80s, who do you want to produce a record? Rick Rubin, you know, that was all right. You know, now Rick didn't, I don't think Rick liked my band very much, but.
Well, he had the Four Horsemen, and we're here. Mm-hmm. We should talk about it. This is Rhino Bucket we're talking about. Right, everyone. Right, get out there, check out those first three Rhino Bucket records.
But I mean, the thing that I was getting at was I really liked what he did with rock records. Not just rock records, I suppose. I like what he did. And once I started working with him, when I saw that we had the same kind of opinions about things and we were excited about the same kinds of things, that sort of gave me the confidence, because someone that I really liked likes what I'm doing too. So I must have a little of that. Like, we have a lot in common, and that's probably why I liked his work when I didn't even know what 1989, I didn't really know what a producer was necessarily, you know, how do you, unless you see one do it. But I know that, you know, a lot of the records I liked had his name on it, so that seemed like a good place to start. So yeah, it's sort of, that's really where I got the confidence that I sort of developed over the years. A lot of it came from that.
But I mean, I think also, and I've noticed this in your style, you're very calm. I mean, I'm sure I don't see all of it.
You do not. I'm sure I
I'm sure I miss some of the fiery moments. Yeah. But overall, you have, as you say, there's a deep trust you have with this band. Mm-hmm. And I think it's something that Rick always had with his bands. And I think it's something that, you know, he had in you and you had in him. I mean, it's a rolling ball of developing. I mean, that's like a fifth sense for a producer, right? To learn how to trust, and also, more importantly, how to get people to trust you. How did you get Metallica to trust you? This is a band who are notorious for sticking to how they do it. Mm-hmm. So how do you get them to this point where they trust you? I mean, again, I think Renee, you'll agree with me. It's remarkable how involved you've become in the live aspect of their sound too.
Right.
I've never seen a relationship and trust like this in the production audio side. Right.
Well, I think I can totally relate to their lack of trust in people coming into their world because I experienced something like that myself, and it was I suppose now I look back at it, I smile, but at the time it was traumatic, the struggles that I had when I was in a band trying to make records and stuff wasn't coming out the way we wanted it, and we were being pushed this way from the label or that way from the label, and we weren't really, you know, we just got confused. And, you know, again, you just don't know, especially then. It's a little bit more known now what everything is and how things work. But at that time, you know, making a record was almost like a mythological thing or something. Like, we didn't really, I don't know how the hell that worked. So lacking the trust, I mean, you know, if you talk to the people that I worked with as a kid, you know, when I was in my early 20s making a record, I mean, I don't know. I think, you know, I worked with Brendan O'Brien, engineered the first Rhino Bucket record, and this is when he was just coming up, and I got along with him, and he was incredibly inspiring. But the producer of that record, I'm not speaking illy of Daniel, I hope, but me and Daniel bumped heads like there was no tomorrow. And I think later on, a friend of mine, Billy Bowers, who ended up being one of Brendan's engineers for many years, I worked with Billy at Sound City way back in the early 90s, or the late 90s, I guess. Billy had said something funny that Brennan had said, yeah, you know, he was tough. Greg was tough, you know. It's because I was an angry young guy, probably not as angry as, you know, Hetfield could be. But I understand, I guess what I'm getting at is I sort of understand that place of not trusting. Right. And, you know, it's your bag of marbles, man. I mean, you don't want anyone messing that up. And
don't touch my marbles.
Yeah. So as I worked with them, you sort of have to tiptoe, I suppose is a good way to put it. And you just show them how important their shit is to you. You know, I mean, and that's certainly, I don't, you know, and I, this is a natural way for me anyways, where, you know, if something's not right, no one is more pissed off about it than me. They are as pissed off about it as I am. And I think once that happened, you know, 500 times or whatever it took for them to finally be like, hey, you know, he's got my back. He's he knows we have similar, you know, likes and things that we like, he likes, and things we don't like, he doesn't like. And he goes to bat just like it's his own. And I think that's how the trust finally, you know, came to be what it is now anyways.
Going from Rhino Bucket to becoming a producer, engineer, all the things that you are today, did you set out to want to be?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I'd left, like I said, to connect a little bit, my experience with Brendan was like really eye-opening.
Uh-huh.
I really, fuck that guy. What is that guy doing? Where is he? He could work all this stuff.
Yeah.
And he could tell me when the G string on my guitar is out of tune. He could pick up the guitar and play the part, you know, as good or better than I can, or if I'm having a hard time figuring something out. It was very like, wow, people could be that.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe I want to be more like that. And then later I worked with Terry Manning on the second Rhino Bucket record, who in very different ways was also very inspiring and very generous with his knowledge and he was very, very great to work with. So by the time those two records were done, I already kind of had it in my head. And I think at one point I tried to even like produce some demos from some local bands when we had some time off. And then towards the end, when things were really not working out with the band and it was clear that it wasn't really going to go where we wanted it to, I knew what I wanted to do. I did not know how to do it, but I knew that I wanted to do it. And I talked with my buddy George, the singer and guitar player of Rhino Bucket, who we were like the best of friends, you know, at that time. We're still very good friends. I just said, look, you know, let's finish this record we're working on and I'll do the one U.S. tour leg and then I'm going to have to bolt. So, yeah. And then took me a little while to figure it out. Getting a job as a runner at Sound City was key, you know?
Yeah, for sure. So I got to ask you about Johnny Cash. So, what did you learn or what have you learned that's been significant?
His presence was intense, Johnny's, but he was, I don't know how, I can't imagine anyone being nicer or more polite or lighter. You know, I'm sure when he was younger, we all know the stories, you know, he was a little bit more of a middle finger kind of guy. But when I worked with him, he was just really easy to approach and kind and very, you know, very grateful.
But did he have that? I think there's a very, very rare energy that comes off the true, true great ones. I really do. And I never met Johnny Cash, mm-hmm. so I don't know. But did he have that?
Definitely. There's a, you know, when he walked in the building, there's a thing. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I've known the guy since, you know, the early 80s, but I think James has that, even though he may not even want to have that.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I don't think he does. But he has it. Would you agree?
I would agree, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Definitely. You know, and James is also obviously a lot younger than Johnny was when I met Johnny, but James isn't the high point of the Hetfield middle finger guy. I don't know that James. I know of that James, but he, by the time I'm working with him, he's already being a little bit more, trying to not be something other than just a guy, you know, is what I think he would really like. But he is more than that, and so in that way, they're sort of, you know, when James comes in, there's a presence and you need to be ready and all that other stuff. But James has also become grateful and tries to be very kind. And, you know, James definitely still has a much more of a mercurial kind of personality where the moods are clear and you know when they're this and that and the other. All good, you know, all good things, but that's a different thing there. Like James could be much harder to sort of dig into and not work with. He's very easy to work with for me anyways, but just to understand, you know, what's happening on the inside there sometimes is a little complicated.
Man, oh man, what a note to end on. That brings us to the end of part one, and you're going to want to tune in next week when we'll have even more to share with you in part two. with the amazing Greg Fittleman.
Oh, yeah. He's going to get into some of the lyric process that he has with James in the studio, which is great. There's going to be Lou Reed. There's going to be some stuff about Lars. There's all sorts of stuff. Greg is great value, and he's going to be great value again next week. Trust us. So until then,
see ya.
The Metallica Report is produced by Metallica HQ, Pantheon Media, and PopCult.
If you like what we're doing here, please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
Be sure to visit Metallica.com/podcast to submit your questions, offer your thoughts, and become a part of this podcast.
Copyright 2023, all rights reserved.